Yes, I can. We were focused
And the fact
again
that
on
they're
our target, a senior commander wolf, and we'll be updating you with more data as the hour moves ahead.
But even if that Hamas commander was there amidst all those Palestinian refugees who are in that Jabalia refugee camp, Israel still went ahead and dropped a bomb there, attempting to kill this Hamas commander, knowing that a lot of innocent civilians, men, women, and children, presumably would be killed. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's not what you're hearing, Wolf. We, again, were focused on this commander, again, who you'll get more data who this man was, killed many, many Israelis. We're doing everything we can. It's a very complicated battle space. There could be infrastructure there. There could be tunnels there. We're still looking into it, and we'll give you more data as the hour moves ahead.
But you know that there are a lot of refugees, a lot of innocent civilians, men, women, and children in that refugee camp as well, right?
This is the tragedy of war, Wolf. I mean, we've been saying for days, move south. Civilians that are not involved with Hamas, please move south.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a little bit more information. You knew there were civilians there, you knew there were refugees, all sorts of refugees, but you decided to still drop a bomb on that refugee camp attempting to kill the Hamas commander. By the way, was he killed?
I can't confirm yet. There'll be more updated.
Welcome, welcome, welcome everybody to Left Reckoning. We're going to be joined in just a little bit by Malaika Jabali to talk about her excellent new book, It's Not You, It's Capitalism. Later in the program, we have a pretty exciting story, a happy one, to talk about. We're going to be talking about the UAW and their historic wins and what this means for the labor movement. And also, don't forget, folks, we're going to be in the post game in just a little bit. Post game. You get access at patreon.com/leftreckoning, where Matt and I are going to be telling some spooky, scary stories. It's going to be a lot of fun, so you want to make sure you come by for that.
How does a guy like me, a skeptic, a scientific skeptic, have multiple stories of the spooky paranormal? Well, you have to become a member to find out.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, y'all. And it'll be much needed, because, as everybody knows, these are extremely dark and difficult times. And I'll just say again, I'm really grateful for this community and the activism and advocacy that people have been doing for Palestinian human rights. And they bombed a refugee camp. They bombed a refugee camp. And there's a lot of videos that we could play. Matt and I had a conversation about which ones we wanted to put up here, because a lot of them are horrific and graphic. This one not excluded. But it's a little bit more zoomed out. But this is the monstrosity and the damage that happened in Gaza.
Yeah, and it's important to note as we play this that there is a sort of censorship regime with regards to atrocities, which is sort of understandable from an ad-supported thing. But what the effect that does is you have one side basically talking about the aesthetic elements of violence as justification for exactly what we're seeing right here. And that these deaths, that quantity isn't up to the quality of other ones that we should lament. So yeah, just note that.
Truly,
we aren't playing the most graphic things because we can't, but notice that it does exist.
I mean, the damage is extreme. It's deep. I mean, there's photographs of the craters. I mean, this is as egregious as it gets. Bombing a refugee center. And as we played for the cold open today, even people like Wolf Blitzer, somebody who regularly runs interference for the Israeli military, is sort of having a hard time covering up for the IDF when they're basically thinking that they're going to get away with the same excuse that they always use when they brutalize, massacre, and murder Palestinians oh, Hamas is using them as human shields. This is a refugee camp. These are people seeking sanctuary and safety. And somebody made a decision to drop a massive bomb on it that left a crater along with hundreds of deaths and injuries of children, of refugees, of human beings. And there's not even a question of like, oh, well, we had bad intel, we made a mistake. No, we knew exactly what we were doing, and we think that price is worth it. It's so disgusting and inhuman. It's unbelievable to still be having these conversations today. There needs to be a ceasefire. Anyone who is still on the fence about that is turning their backs on humanity itself. When you support something like this, you are walking away from the very thing that makes us human, which is our capacity to have empathy and care for our neighbors and people all across the globe. It's, I mean, what else can you say at this point, Matt? I mean, it was already simple in a general sense before. I mean, what can you say after seeing something like this?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, like Wolf Blitzer, who is, worked with AIPAC, I mean, and this is the thing, is like, they can't really, this is what they've always been saying, except it was filtered in a way that had less sort of dimension to it, and it was less, people were less able to understand. This is what they've always meant by human shields. This is what always, it's, if we need to drop a bomb on a building where there are dozens and dozens to hundreds of innocent people to get one person that we've declared a terrorist, that is a price we are willing to pay. And we don't really care about innocence. We don't care. And it has been amazing and infuriating to be told by the people who justify this that we are the ones that do not care about the slaughter of innocents. No, this is terrorism too. If we're going to be objective about the slaughter of innocents to make a political point, this is that at a way higher scale and with our government's funding. It is terrorism. Israel is a terrorist state, and it is not just under the Bibi Netanyahu thing. You look back at the last 75 years here, the sort of bombing so the Arabs flee, that didn't start recently. This is a long time policy. And actually, you know, that gives us the opportunity to maybe get into one of the dumb debates. I just want to say, like, some top lines, things that have changed in addition to like the continued massacre of civilians, like at this hospital. The FT, the Financial Times, basically sort of one of the leading capitalist newspapers of the West in England, called for a ceasefire. So at least let's peg that. That's something to throw back at, say, Bernie Sanders or anybody else who like doesn't want to call for a ceasefire now, that at least there's that. So put your peg in that and try to get that to pull it up. The other thing that's been going on is the Atlantic Magazine, which was formed in opposition to slavery in this country, has become a complete neocon rag and is having mass market historians who are literally in Jeffrey Epstein's book, like Salmon Sebag Montefiore. And just to put the detail here, here is his name in this book for folks so people can see it. But he's you know, Jeffrey Epstein had this guy's right there details. But anyway, let's address his points before or after going ad hominem. He has this piece in The Atlantic. The decolonization narrative is dangerous and false. And this is indicative of this entire industry of Israel apologists, which is, I think, it cannot actually deal with adults, and it'd have to pretend like everything is a hallucination by a campus activist who's just learned about this. So it does not accurately describe either the foundation of Israel nor the tragedy of Palestine. Now, I don't pay for The Atlantic. I never will. So I only have so much of this. But I do think there's a few things. One, he calls From the River to the Sea just a chilling phrase that implicitly endorses the killing or deportation of the 9 million Israelis. No, it doesn't. It means freedom for everybody in between those. That is a hysterical thing for a person that immediately just blows his credibility. And then what does he say here? As if it was an attack basically by a... as if Hamas had just carried out a traditional military operation against soldiers. Hamas can't do this because Hamas ain't a traditional military, because Palestine isn't afforded one of those for self-defense, because that would get in the way of Israel taking their houses. And but this sort of like, for this discussion as to like, oh, they're not settlers. This is, again, the maintenance of an infantile understanding of this, because if you look to any of the founding fathers of Israel, it's absolutely clear. They are very clear. And so let's go to a little bit of this. This is from Let's see here. One second. Pull this up. Theodor Herzl, the Jewish state. Believe that was 1896. I don't know the exact name on this, but just let's look at some of the text here. Here's one. Should the powers declare themselves willing to admit our sovereignty over a neutral piece of land, then the society will enter into negotiations for the possession of this land. Here are the two territories come under consideration, Palestine and Argentine. In both countries, important experiments in colonization have been made. Right? Interesting that that is just explicitly said there. Also, Herzl wrote to Cecil Rhodes, who people might understand as...
the white man's burden.
That one. Right, exactly. And here it is. Let me pull this up here so we can get a look at this piece of text. Here it is. And I'll make this a little bit bigger, but you get the sense that he's literally appealing to the leading man of Rhodesia. The England's white settlement in southern Africa. And he says, how then did I happen to turn to you, since this is out of the way matter for you? How indeed? Because it is something colonial, and because it presupposes understanding of a development which will take 20 to 30 years. So this misunderstanding, which points mm-hmm. to the, of course, Jews that existed in the land, what they're doing here, Seebag, is throwing in the terms like decolonization and indigenous when they're not applicable here mm-hmm. because there was if you would have asked Herzl, like, who are the natives and who are the settlers, he would have been very clear about who that is. Now that there is some birthright to it, that means that yes, Jews should be allowed to live there too. Jews should be allowed to live wherever they want in the world, but not as mm-hmm. a supreme and privileged ethnic group. They should be able to live there democratically. And that's what From the River to the Sea means. When people celebrate it out here, they are not celebrating the slaughter of Jewish people. And to mm-hmm. go into the Atlantic newspaper and to peddle that understanding to people is absolutely disgusting. And it's the type of thing you would expect from somebody who is in Jeffrey Epstein's book.
Well, there you go. You know, and I just to add to this, Matt, I mean, you know, when we're talking about what's going on right now, we're talking about mass slaughter and killing of Palestinians. So sometimes having like these kind of cultural philosophical arguments can seem a little secondary, but it's absolutely critical in the case of Palestine and Israel. There has been an ongoing project not only to murder and kill and expel the Palestinians from the area, but to deny them their own history, to deny them their own culture, to deny them their own food. This is why, you know, you'll sometimes hear somebody who's Palestinian or an advocate, you know, get very frustrated at like American restaurants that will say, oh, we're serving traditional Israeli food. Well, no, it's not traditional Israeli food. This is traditional Palestinian food. And because the people who came into that area colonized and settled it and expelled people didn't have that kind of local tradition, they had to take from somebody else and then say, oh, actually, this is ours now. We own this. And it's an attempt to, one, kind of justify the presence of people there, the expulsion of Palestinians, and also to sort of be able to tell this narrative where now you have people, yeah, making these claims of indigenous and things like that, which is absurd. It's truly brutal. And like, you know, kind of like small example, but Matt, I know you're probably familiar with a lot of like the Scandinavian history of doing this in the Northern Plains, you know, where Scandinavians would come in here and then people would sort of etch fake like Viking runes and things like that in caves so that they could be like, oh, look, actually, we've been here for a really long time, right? A similar kind of project of, you know, destroying a local people and then saying, actually, we have ancient claims to this.
Right, which ancient claims, which also look a lot like English property law, right? And it's not like claims as if like we get to live here. It's that we get to live here and exclude y'all from
yes,
it. And
yes.
That's like, that's really where it is. Because like, it's true, like this is a common part of like settler mythologizing that isn't, and it's true in the case of Jewish people. Jews did live in that area. Now, mm-hmm. Which like ethnic groups and different lineages, like a different thing, but like, fundamentally, it doesn't really matter because it doesn't even like land back in the States doesn't mean we get to just exclude everyone there. It's a more common understanding of governance, properly understood. But with the Mandan Indians, the tribe that where I'm from, there was literally a lord in like Wales when the first reports of the upper Midwest region were coming back to Europe, and the Mandan tribe was reported to have lighter skin, and all these Europeans got the idea that actually they were descended from us. Actually, if you look back in our history, one of our guys sent a boat across the Atlantic, and maybe that's them, right? And it's like that's the sort of like myth making you do because, understandably, you kind of have a guilty conscience. But like again. Jews should be allowed to live in that region and 100%. Anywhere, and anti-Semitism is absolutely appalling, but they should not be able to exclude Arabs, as they say, because they don't even want to use the term Palestinians from that land. And like it's like I was just reading Ilan Pappi's Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. It's like you look at what happened to Nazareth in the Nakba, and Nazareth survived because it was 10,000 Christians and 6,000 Palestinian Muslims, and the world knew that, like, okay, Americans, Christians aren't going to really be cool with us expelling that people. Like these sorts of, this is the reality of the kind of like colonial and dispossession, like the only reason, because the orders were there to expel all of those people, and Herzl himself, or maybe no, Ben-Gurion, sorry, not Herzl, like, get my founders of Israel mixed up, but said, you know what, the eyes are on that, let's not do that. And you know, we have to face this sort of reality clearly, and that you have leading New York Times best-selling historians getting pride of place in the Atlantic magazine to just basically infantilize their audience is exactly why we're where we are.
100%. Well, we have one more clip we want to play.
Yeah. And so this is a clip of Michael. This is February 7th, 2019, Jeffrey Halper, episode 76 of TMBS. Jeffrey Halper is the founder of the Israeli Committee Against Housing Demolitions. Originally born in Minnesota and moved to Israel in the 70s. While being fully cognizant of the issues that were settler colonial states. And Michael has a good question here, which I think gets to the point of like, is this just a Bibi Netanyahu thing, or is there maybe a wider, more foundational problem that we have to actually address and not hope just goes away? And here it is.
There's this rosy-eyed history, and some people even hold this other narrative that Israel was this great, incredible thing, and then it was corrupted by Likud and Netanyahu, and of course that isn't true. But then conversely, the other narrative that Israel was always just, all it ever is was just this settler right-wing thing. It was a settler thing, but there was complexities to, you know, a labor socialist government, then the rise of the sort of neoliberals, then you even have Ehud Barak in a third way, and then a forerunner of this sort of resurgent far right that we see across the Western Hemisphere, starting when Netanyahu came back to power in 2008. So can you talk to us just about those kind of big periods of broader Israeli political history that you have seen?
Well, yes and no. Because in fact, I mean, if you look at the last 125 years of Zionism, it was a settler colonial movement.
Well, that's objectively true. I mean,
you can't, get away from that.
Right.
And they were more liberal settler colonialists, and they were more conservative, more religious, and more secular. But that was, you know, in other words, the Zionist movement, that was a left socialist nationalist movement in the turn of the 20th century,
right,
came to the country with the intention of taking it over, of Judaizing the country. In other words, transforming an Arab country into a Jewish country, transforming Palestine into the land of Israel. And that was the agenda. So in a sense, whether you're on the right or on the left, you had that same political logic. You know, the it was the left, you might say, the Labor Party, that founded the State of Israel. It was them that did the ethnic cleansing of 1948, that destroyed all the Palestinian villages, drove half the Palestinians out. It was a Labor Party
explain
that did
the Nakba for people. I think a lot of people will know, but
well, the Nakba is the Arab term for what happened in 1948. We call it the War of Independence in Israel. They call it the Nakba, which means the catastrophe. And in 1948, there was a concerted campaign to ethnically cleanse the country, because the country had been partitioned into two states by the UN, a Jewish state than an Arab state. But the Jews were only a third of the population, were newcomers to the country, and yet the UN gave them 56% of the land.
Well, I just like sharing that because that's the type of guy that all of these people, whether it's, you know, the people who don't want to say it's apartheid and what do words mean? Stop trying to shadow box these imaginary campus activists who you think you know better than. Deal with people who actually live there and are like active in decolonizing it. If you want to make fun of that term, you want to have quibbles with it, talk to somebody who's actually in Israel starting groups against housing demolitions. This sort of shadow boxing that, I mean, Pacman does it, Brian Beutler did it when he says it's not genocide just because Israel is not doing a genocide. I saw Michael Tracy saying he doesn't use propaganda terms like ethnic cleansing.
Nice.
Deal with somebody who actually uses them.
Mm-hmm.
And don't just find some campus activist. Go ahead.
I'll just say this. At a certain point, you know, we all live our lives and we get sort of pulled into certain things, right? By our environment, by our community, family, things like that, right? Like everyone has had like kind of political positions that they may have, you know, inherited or been taught.
Right.
But a very simple test that you can take to see that if this political project, right, is worth supporting is to maintain this system, to maintain this dream. Does it mean dropping bombs on refugee camps? Does it mean holding millions of people in an open-air prison? Does it mean denying people water and food? And we're not just talking about the ongoing siege of Gaza. We're talking about the daily life of Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza, and also what's going on with Palestinians who live inside of Israel. If your political project regularly puts you in a position where you have to apologize for crimes against humanity, for mass slaughter, for mass degradation of other people's humanity, you should take a good long look in the mirror and ask yourself, what the fuck am I doing right here? And that's sort of it at the end of the day. I mean, really, if you are in this position regularly where you are having to deny atrocities like people who support Israel are having to do today, got to take a real long look at yourself, friend.
The atrocities, again, people need to understand, they're not just a Bibi Netanyahu thing. These sorts of bombing of civilian populations, I'll just read from Pappy's ethnic cleansing again. The long seminar participants were called in for another meeting on 19 February 1948, 4 days after the attack on Sa'saa. It was Thursday morning. They met once again in Ben-Gurion's home, and the Zionist leader recorded the discussion almost verbatim in his diary. The purpose was to examine the impact of the Lamed Hay operations on the Palestinians. Josh Paulman brought the Orientalist point of view. The Palestinian showed no inclination to fight. He was supported by Ezra Denin, who reported, "The villagers show no wish to fight. Moreover, the ALA was clearly confining its activities to the areas the UN resolution had allocated to the future Palestinian state." Ben-Gurion was unimpressed. His thoughts were already somewhere else. He wasn't happy with the limited scope of the operations. A small reaction to Arab hostility does not impress anyone. A destroyed house, nothing. Destroy a neighborhood, and you begin to make an impression.
Yep.
And so we see neighborhoods leveled.
Yeah, man. You know, and this is a time where it's clearer than ever. What the stakes are, what the cost is, and the only humane position to take is a ceasefire and an end to the occupation. So we'll continue promoting that. People need to continue coming after elected officials who are denying mass murder right now. It's going to be a very hard and difficult fight. It's horrifying to think that, you know, this is only just beginning in a lot of ways. But I've taken a lot of inspiration from the actions like we saw in New York City, all across the country, in San Francisco, also in London.
Man, London, yeah. That bridge shot was insane.
So keep doing it because it is making a difference right now. As we played at the beginning of the show, even somebody like Wolf Blitzer, who's been very comfortable running interference for atrocities in the first place, is struggling a bit, and we need to keep the pressure up. Folks, I know this is it's tough sometimes to talk about anything else, but we got a full show for y'all. In a little bit, we're going to talk about this huge win for the UAW, what it means, and sort of break down some aspects of that. But before we do that, we're going to be joined now by our really good friend, Malika Jamali to talk about her new book, It's Not You, It's Capitalism. Really thrilled to have her back on the program again. She was the very first guest of Left Reckoning, and I hope you all enjoy the conversation. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, joined as always by my good friend and comrade, Matt Leck. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, David. Good to be with you.
Yeah, man. I mean, we're very excited today. We are joined by Malika Jabali, senior news and politics editor at Essence and author of this new book, It's Not You, It's Capitalism. But most importantly, the very first guest that we had on Left Reckoning, and we're very happy to have her back on the program. Thank you so much for coming by.
I didn't realize I made history. Let's go. Thanks for the
reminder. I mean, that was January 6th, too. So it was a very funny episode. Oh,
what an inaugural feature. So yeah, that was great. That's also my birthday. So I was probably pissed. But I think I went on a rant for like 20 minutes about how mad I was.
Another one of their many crimes. Well,
right. Thank you. Number one.
Well, I mean, I'm really happy to have you here. And people, if you haven't already been reading Malika's work, you know, across the board, it's really phenomenal. And this book here, It's Not You, It's Capitalism, is a really great kind of crash course into, I don't know, socialist thought, critiques of capitalism. It's incredibly readable. It's fun. The illustrations are phenomenal. I really, you know, we read a lot of books critiquing capitalism on this program, and no shade to anyone else, but this was a very fun and engaging text. So I really did appreciate that. But I mean, I was wondering if maybe to start us off, we'll go a little bit more in depth into some of these things, but I mean, what was it that compelled you to write this book and also write it in the way that you did?
It was a mix of things. I have thought about how do we get more everyday people into the fold. I think a lot of leftists think about that. How do we make these ideas approachable? And it was really synergy because I had an editor who had read one of my Jacobin essays where I'm talking about the working class and how Black people are often left out of it and how it's just whitewashed in general. She read that essay and then she hasn't told me how much she like cyber stalked or whatever, but she was like, I read some more stuff. And then she ended up reaching out to me about doing an approachable guide to socialism. And so I was thinking, well, what if, and she wanted to illustrate it. She wanted it fun. She wanted to center people of color, socialists of color. So I was like, okay, I'm all about that. But then as I started to write it, I started to think about relationship metaphors. I was in New York or I had been in New York. Going through a couple breakups. Y'all know dating in New York City is so much fun. And so I was naturally incorporating some of that into the manuscript. But then, you know, after some time, which, you know, we can probably get into the origin story later, I was like, this really needs to be a whole relationship allegory. Like the whole book can center capitalism being a toxic relationship. So I have to just shout out, you know, Madeline Jones, or, you know, that's my editor at Algonquin, who like wanted something. But I also felt like a lot of people may not really feel compelled to call themselves socialists. So I really wanted to center a critique of capitalism because I think a lot of people are there, you know, where we're like, this system is fundamentally flawed, but I don't know if I'm socialist yet. So I didn't use socialism on the cover. I was like, let's talk about this beast and then get into why you should be socialist.
Yeah, I want to say it's a great stocking stuffer for the coming holiday season for somebody like that maybe like is there like they can see rent is too high, they're struggling with student loan debt or something like that, but they are like, I'm not ideological, I'm not a politics person. You give them this and you see some actual like guides there. And I want to dwell on the metaphor a little bit because I'm seeing a lot of this, and It's Not You, It's Capitalism is, I think, literally a message that people need to hear, especially young people. Because we see a lot of things when it comes to like loneliness and stuff like that. And so often on like YouTube, for instance, the solutions people are saying, or the sort of like culprit is pointed to like, well, it's not you, it's feminism, or it's sort of diversity or something like that. And like, it's a real big problem. Cause when I look at like, what was the problem for me dating, you know, after I went to grad school, in part because the economy sucked, but I had to take out loans for that. And then it's like, it's because I have these loans. And I have to get these loans to pay. Like, that was the worst thing. It was just very obviously, it's not a metaphor. It's like, this structure is what's getting everybody down. We can't buy a house, like you mentioned in the book. Like, these sorts of things, we aren't able to, like, put ourselves first. And then we're, like we're given all these other culprits for that. And it is just, the system we're under.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way of thinking about it. And I think, part of why I wanted to center, I really do center conversations about race and racism and white supremacy and how that was fundamental to the creation of capitalism. Because instead of blaming or instead of even acknowledging that there's this larger beast out there, I think there's a tendency to blame each other. It's not me. It's like, it's all these dudes out here. It's not me. You know, it's like this black person over there. It's this immigrant who's coming to town. And so it keeps us with a very narrow, divisive focus instead of something that we can all, you know, come together and say our bosses are messing over our lives. Or if we don't have a boss, because a lot of people are still unemployed, a system that, you know, allows unemployment to happen. Like, we're not thinking more structurally. And I was talking to somebody about that. Because, you know, I've been wanting to understand why that is, you know, and I think it's kind of like with climate change, some of those things seem really abstract, but the people that you interact with on an everyday basis, like, you can name like the girl that you went out on a date with and like, and blame them. But like, how do you blame this like faceless, you know, the propaganda machine? Like, it's not very tangible. So this is a way, I think, of even making it tangible by saying, oh, this does remind me of like how a relationship works, because that's such an intimate relationship.
Right, right.
And like, even on that, you know, even some people who have been converted to, they'll talk about capitalism so abstractly that it can be really helpful to root them in those like very specific things that you do in your book, right? Whereas, no, these are actual like social and material relations that are affecting you. And I was maybe to sort of tee us up on that, you know, in the kind of style of your book, and I mean, in your own style, I mean, how would you describe what capitalism is to somebody who's asking you for the first time what it is? Because I think, you know, a lot of people get really tripped up on that.
Yeah. It's a system where a small amount of people control their resources and decisions and the profits of how a company is run. So socialism says, in, you know, as an alternative, people, the workers, should decide how a company is run. And so whether, you know, that means that people vote on, you know, everybody having equal pay. So regardless of what position you have in a company, people can decide that democratically. Or they can decide, okay, well, a founder, they invested so much time and resources, so maybe they can get a little bit more. But when it's democratic, at least you're bringing everybody to the table, like one person and one vote, instead of a board of directors, like 6, 7, however many people that are like on the average corporate board, deciding basically how whole communities should live. Because if, you know, A.O. Smith, which is a company that's based in Wisconsin where I lived, if they just decide, hey, we want to completely shutter, you know, this car business and do, you know, water filtration, and we're going to go out to China, they can do that. And a whole zip code, a whole city can be destroyed by that. We just are saying socialism should allow people to make those decisions democratically.
And Malika, about, oh, sorry, go ahead, David.
Oh, you go. You go.
Well, about a third of the way through, you go off on Wisconsin and some of the first that it does. Can you just let people know some of the things Wisconsin that should be proud of?
Yeah, well, for just to give people a little bit of context, when FDR was looking at the New Deal, when he was looking at his New Deal programs, he pulled a lot of economists from Wisconsin. And Chicago is known, you know, the University of Chicago is known for having this laissez-faire. Like, there's a specific Chicago school of economics that is very individualized. It's hyper-capitalist. But there were economists in Wisconsin, which is just one state over, who said, we actually need to center workers in this. And they came from this economist named John Commons, who identified as a socialist. So essentially, we had a whole school of economics that came out of UW-Madison, that was influenced by John Commons, a socialist. And so because of that, Wisconsin became like the first state to have workers' comp. They had like their own version of like a social security. They wanted to make sure that there was unemployment insurance. And so these are essentially ideas. I don't know if you want to call it socialist ideas per se, or they're ideas that came from a socialist, however you want to describe it, or a socialist school of thought that ended up becoming a model for the rest of the country. And so FDR pulled these economists who came out of this school, like literally from, you know, UW-Madison, and put them in various leadership positions as they were coming up with, you know, the ideas for Social Security and Medicare and things like that throughout the country.
Right.
Well, I mean, I want to get into some of these models here, but not to be too laser focused on the capitalism question. One thing that I really appreciated in your book was that you sort of took apart like a kind of a very important distinction. And one thing, two things are very conflated a lot, which is being a capitalist versus being a consumer. Now, Malaika, you wrote a book and you're selling that book for money. So aren't you a capitalist?
Sorry, that's not quite how it works. I hope you actually read the book, because then you wouldn't make that argument. the hypothetical person, obviously not you, David. Because I had somebody who DM'd me, was like, you're making money off this book. Are you going to redistribute the profits? First of all, that's not how publishing works. Like, I'm not making money right now. This is a loan, like student loans that I have to pay back. Anyway, if they don't get
sold. It's actually an important point for people who don't know that.
Right, like, no, I'm not like... I'm not like rolling in dough right now from this. So just buying things does not make you a capitalist, or even selling things. People had markets, people traded, people were involved in industry prior to capitalism. Capitalism is a distinct form of a market enterprise and a distinct form of a business organization where, again, you have a small group of people who are using wage labor. They're exploiting the labor of a large amount of people, everyday people like us, to make a profit. And they make all the decisions with how that profit is spent. They can decide to put into stock options. They can decide to give a CEO a gajillion dollars if they want to. And they can do that because our laws support it. Corporate law supports it. The Supreme Court supports those kinds of precedents. It's a system. So somebody just saying, hey, I just want to like buy clothes. No, that does not make you a capitalist. I want to have a form of communication and buy an iPhone. That also does not make you a capitalist.
Yeah. And I mean, I would just add too that like, it's always rich when you hear people make those kind of arguments that like doing something is like being a capitalist, right? When in fact it's the capitalists are the people who aren't working in the first place. Right. And it's like the working class are the people who are doing all these things. And we should have pride in the things that workers produce. They're incredibly important. And it's always bizarre to me to see like the people who, you know, the logic of a capitalist is you make, I take, basically, sit around and say, you know, oh, all these things that you enjoy, from the food on your table to the car that you drive, it all comes from me, a capitalist. It's like, no, it comes from thousands upon thousands of workers spending their time working for a wage producing those commodities. Right. So it's bizarre to me to let those guys get away with that argument.
Yeah. And I think it's also based on a very archaic notion of what capitalism is, because there are so many capitalists who didn't found, like they didn't create the companies that are creating these widgets and creating these products. You know, some of them, they come in and they're using, you know, these financial tools to be able to buy out companies. They know nothing about it. Like I remember an anecdote with some factory workers. I want to say this one was in Indiana. And so I think it was actually Mitt Romney's, what was his Bain Capital that came in, and they basically built a stage and people were so like, it was like almost mythological at this point, because people repeated this story so many times because it just hurt them to their core, where he just came in, where his company came in, and they're like, okay, you guys like built this stage. It was workers for this company. And they built the stage in order for the corporate leaders of Bain Capital to then tell them they were all getting fired because they were going to like essentially bankrupt the company and then like pivot to another company after that, you know? And so these are, it's such a huge financialization where corporate leadership is not even tied to products that much anymore. It's just tied to how clever you can be with, you know, just maneuvering the system.
Right. We talked a little bit about that with like the shareholder buybacks. Like these people, they come from business schools with no real idea except how to maximize short-term profit to make it look good in the stock market. And like Linda Yaccarino at Twitter, like is she there because she knows how to make a really good you know, social media app, or is she there because she's trying to, you know, be Elon's henchman? Dave, if you want, I kind of want to get into your origin story in Jackson, Mississippi, unless David, you had a question to follow up there. Let's go there.
Yeah. So a key element of the book is to show that socialism is not this foreign, scary entity, that it was integral to how a lot of people conceived of their liberation and fought for their liberation and fought for equity in the U.S. And so I didn't get into all of this, but in Alabama, for instance, Robin D.G. Kelly, he has this book called Hammer and Hope, where he talks about a communist movement in Alabama, where farmers out there, agricultural workers, they recognize that communism was built around equity. And so for them, that was a way of refuting and repudiating like a system of segregation that told them that they were inferior, that they weren't even human, and that they were, or second class citizens at best. So in the 60s, I would say around the Black Power era, there were a group of Black folks who felt like the civil rights movement hadn't gone far enough. So they're like, you know, we need to just create our own kind of government in the South. Let's go back to our roots. You know, a lot of Black people migrated up north, places like Detroit, Milwaukee, New York, all over the place. And so a group of them started in Detroit and then came down to Jackson, Mississippi. And that's where they formed, I would say, kind of their headquarters. And I was a beneficiary of that. I grew up in Atlanta. And so Jackson was almost like a sister city where those founders then created like other groups, and they wanted to attract younger people and be more political. And so I grew up in an organization, and one of the, I've mentioned this actually on your show with Michael years ago, but I grew up as a new African scout, and we didn't have the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. But as a part of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, it had these like roots in these socialist tenets where they wanted Black people to have land, but to treat it equitably, to distribute, you know, anything that came from the land, to distribute that equitably. So it had all these like kind of socialist practices, and I think those early years is really what made me realize that I could be critical of the country. I didn't have to just accept, you know, really the propaganda that we've been fed with in our school systems. So it really just gave me, I think, the early stages of just criticizing the country and being critical of our systems.
And we've talked about Jackson a number of times in the past couple of years. I'm curious, like that sort of ideological lineage, the Chokwe Lumumba senior and junior, and that this entire, how much of the what we're seeing with regards to the antagonism the wider state of Mississippi gets is the general we don't like urban areas and Black people in this area, and how much of is it like we need to make sure this political project gets snuffed out?
Yeah, you know, I wish I knew more about the modern or the contemporary like conflicts with the state. Mm. You know, I cover it some in my role, you know, as an editor at Essence. And so just to give people some background, one of the founders of this group of the Malcolm X grassroots movement is Chokwe Lumumba Sr. And it was a really long-standing political project where he eventually became mayor, I want to say in 2014. And then he passed away like prematurely. It was a very untimely death. He passed away early into his administration, then some years passed. And then his son, Chokwe Antar Lumumba, ended up succeeding him. But Chokwe was socialist. He was a revolutionary nationalist, all these things. And so I am sure, like through campaigning, that they were aware of his background. He worked as Lumumba Senior worked as an activist and a lawyer for a really long time. You know, and as fun as this book is, and as fun as I think socialism will make our lives, unfortunately, socialists have also been targets of the state. So I would not be surprised. Again, this is not from any reporting or anything like that. I just wouldn't be surprised based on the history if he had been surveilled or, you know, watched. He was a revolutionary and he wasn't shy about it, who ended up having state power. So
it'd be surprised if he wasn't, I think, in this country.
Exactly. Like, I might be on a list somewhere at this rate. You know what I mean? Like, everybody knows everything. That kind of tension is, I would not be surprised if that was a part of the larger antagonism from the state, because they're doing everything they can to try and, you know, make Jackson seem illegitimate.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're basically defunding Jackson and trying to strip it of democracy effectively. But on that, I mean, I think one thing that is clear in a lot of your work, and it's also in this book, is sort of wrestling with and challenging with the kind of popular conception of who is the working class.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to talk about, you know, one, sort of setting the record straight about who the working class is, but also, I mean, I'm curious as to your thoughts as to why, I don't know, certain, let's call them, you know, liberals, people in the Democratic Party try to also do this conflation of like, oh, if you're talking about working people, what that means is that you're trying to exclude people of color from your vision for the future. I'm curious if you could sort of set the record straight on that, and also talk about why that's been such a media tactic of certain people.
The working class is multiracial. It is, it goes obviously across gender. And so I think the reason why these myths hold, or these images hold, where we're centering, you know, Midwestern white factory men in this picture, is just because it's easy. I think when it comes to both the media and when it comes to the political seasons, those are just easy tropes to glom onto. And unfortunately, where you see this a lot, like in cable news, there's not a lot of reporting that happens. There's not a lot of people just actually going on the ground and going in Midwestern cities, because these cable news programs are based on the East Coast. Like, the talking heads are in shows on the East Coast. And so the, you know, they use that, you know, coastal elites as a way to say, oh, this is like real America. This is real white America. I'm using that as a way to say, actually, middle America has a critical mass of people of color. It has people who have been deindustrialized out of being able to have that factory narrative, who are, you know, working multiple shifts at an Amazon warehouse, who are driving Lyfts and Ubers because all they can get is gig work, who have been targeted by the state, so they have to go through a different kind of gig economy where they can't do either, and so they're just like, you know, selling Lucy's or doing something in like an underground economy to make ends meet. And so, you know, we need to acknowledge just how multifaceted it is if we actually are serious about having a working class movement. Mm-hmm.
100%. And like on that, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. I mean, one thing you'll see a lot if you spend any time, and unfortunately spending way too much time doing this, I say to mine stuff for the show, but I'm as guilty as anyone else, just scrolling through TikTok and stuff. You get these kind of arguments from people that, like, you know, for minorities, particularly for Black people, that basically what needs to happen is there needs to be a kind of like Black capitalist revolution, right? That, like, you know, by doing certain, I don't know, by hustling, making some money, you know, you'll be able to get out of it. I mean, could you talk about why that's probably not the best model for an entire movement or people, particularly with the way that capitalism is set up and the inequality that's baked into that system?
Yeah, I think we have been brainwashed so much in this country thinking that everybody can own a mom and pop shop, when the reality is, in this day and age, you need at least $100,000, like, on average. People who claim on their taxes today that they're self-employed and they have their own business, they have a net worth of at least $100,000. That cuts out so many Americans. But we have been primed to think of that as, you know, American and emblematic of our freedom and emblematic of just the kind of prosperity that we can have in this country. But it's not that easy. You know, having wealth begets more wealth. So to say that something that requires wealth will get you out of wealth is tautological. You know, and that's what happens. Like, we just end up stuck thinking that we're just not doing enough. We're not hustling hard enough. But a lot of folks who have the benefit of being able to create a business had some kind of assistance some type of way. Like, you know, you hear of somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, came from like a solidly upper middle class family. He's got resources. He's got a network of people who can give him money, like, you know, family members who could just chip in, you know, 10,000 here and 30,000 there, or a million here or whatever. Most people do not have that. I do not know exactly what your question was, but I went down that path, so I hope I answered it. So in terms of, you know, Black people coming out of it, when you look at our net worth, I think the median Black family has maybe $20,000 in net wealth. That might even be an exaggeration. So that cuts out a lot of us right there. And then secondly, if it would have happened, kind of like, you know, with relationships, if they wanted to, they would. So if this would have happened for us under capitalism, wouldn't you think it would have happened in some way by now? We haven't even seen us remotely get to that point of capitalism being like a freedom driver for us. And as I argue with the book, and as you all know, capitalism has relied on Black exploitation. It has relied on Black labor. It has relied on our enslavement. So how can we then look at it as a model for liberation?
Yeah, you mentioned the manifesto and the whole, like, where the minimum wage is designed to make sure we never let people graduate beyond that. And that, you know, is in, and you know, you hear about like generational wealth too. And I think like on an individual family level, that sounds great, but it's not fundamentally going to lead to a wider liberation, because really what you're doing with that wealth is investing it into something that can make money with money. And that requires you to be exploiting people who work to produce that stuff. And so that's why, like, you always see these like hustles, and it's often like when you follow it through, it's like, try to get this asset that you can charge people for and get passive income. And it's like, well, yeah, like I get that not everybody is going to be able to do that, because somebody needs to go work for a wage that to pay the renters fund at a certain point.
Exactly. You know, and so it bothers me when I hear people use this rhetoric of, you know, Black power and Black liberation to just say we need Black capitalism. Because if you actually care about the liberation of our people, you would know that most of us are going to still be workers. And so you're just looking for replicating a relationship that already exists. We're exploiting workers. You know, it's not like Black capitalists have shown to be any better than other capitalists, you know? Like, are there studies that they're paying them beyond a minimum wage? Are they paying them a living wage? Are they giving them, you know, equal health care? Or not equal health care, but are they giving them health care? That's not, you know, we don't have that kind of evidence.
They would lose. They would lose. Like, and this is something that I always try to remind people of. It's like, look, we can, like, I have a lot of moral feelings about capitalism and things like that. And like the billionaires people sitting on top, they have my contempt. But it's also like the system creates them. And what I mean by that is like the things that they do to people are things that make sense for their business to do. So if you want to be in that position, you're going to do that. Exactly. So like to even think that you could replicate it in some kind of nice way, I think you put it well when you say, you know, they would have done it by now. I mean, it's very clear that there's no kind of way of exploiting your workers in a nice way, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. Because they want to compete. And then it almost becomes like this reverse pathology. Well, I'm not going to call out all the people, but it's just like, well, you want me to survive. You know, why can't I be a Black capitalist? Don't you want me to survive in this economy? And to survive in this economy, like, we're going to have to do certain things. So race is then used as like a buffer to keep away like certain criticism of their bad practices. Like, well, you know, Black businesses got to survive. Like, don't you want us to survive? Mm-hmm. Like, no, not this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's why it's important you have like the discussion of the persistence of inequality throughout time, and that capitalism isn't making this better. Because I think growing up, we could have seen like, oh, actually markets, and look at Bill Clintonism, and all you'd need to do is just encourage, you know, small business owners to do stuff. And like that doesn't actually work out. But if you do believe in that mythology, I guess it's a little bit understandable. I just think at this point in our history, in 2023, we've seen what's happened to people's wealth, like after the financial crisis, even like since the 70s, like you have the figures about like the wage growth, and like business startups are also way down since then, because people, like you said, don't have the startup capital to do them.
Right. I mean, and you know, running a business is hard. Like, why do we, you know, just, I guess, ideology aside, we really think everybody wants to, you know, be responsible for dozens or hundreds of people's lives? Like, do you think everybody really wants to have to do administrative work? I just have to, you know, manage like a small group of freelancers with my job. I don't like doing paperwork. I do not want to have to, like, you know, hustle my way and administrative task my way into economic security. Like, some things should just be provided. Some things should just be basic human rights.
Well, on that too, you know, we've been talking about like the kind of two big systems, capitalism versus socialism. But you really rooted it in a few different examples, from housing to healthcare to education. I mean, could you talk about some of those things that we have under capitalism that are holding people back, and also some of the different ideas that we have to sort of deal with things like student debt and housing and healthcare?
Yeah, I think housing has some of the most salient examples. I think with healthcare, everyone's just like, okay, we just need, you know, single payer universal healthcare. I think housing is really interesting to me because it's complex. I think it's the most complex issue that I had to write about. It's also the one that I happen to have policy experience in. I worked as a housing public policy attorney for the Land Use Committee, and then just looking at the Public Housing Committee, by the way, with Richie Torres. He was the chair at the time. I don't know if anybody's familiar with him. anyway, but yes, I worked in housing policy, and even within professionals, a group of experts, we had a lot of conversations and I would say quagmires around just what housing means, you know, because New York City, they're, we're treating it as a commodity. You know, we're treating it as, we want to have as much development as possible. We want to have developers come in and create, you know, stories and stories of housing for people, with the assumption that a larger supply will, you know, bring costs down. That has not happened. And that's like with rental housing. But then the other problem is that a lot of people can be homeowners. The majority of white families are homeowners, so it doesn't have the same kind of like boss worker exploitative relationship. But you do have people who have like a homeowner renter antagonism. So, you know, there are just so many problems with it. And I don't think we've quite figured it out because it's such an intimate issue. It's where we live. It's where we have, you know, where we lay our heads. And there's all, I can go down all kinds of, you know, thoughts about that in terms of the rhetoric that we use about, you know, people coming to your neighborhoods, and that used as like a political wedge. But there are plenty of options that we've had in the United States. You know, public housing is one of them. Whether or not we can get that in the U.S., knowing, you know, where our federal government's priorities lie, that's an issue. But we had public housing for white families, who are working class in droves. Atlanta was actually one of the first places where we had a public housing development. And that was seen as a way to kind of advance, you know, to have some upward mobility. Public housing is one. There are other types of kind of government sponsored housing. So Singapore, even though it's a capitalist country, they allow people to essentially do like that. It's almost like a CL, a community land trust, where you have like a 99-year long lease, which is pretty much, you know, most people's lifetimes, if not a little bit longer, and you give it back to the state when you're done, and then they make sure to keep the cost down in between the transfers of that, so it's not just constantly ballooning. There's just so many examples. Y'all should read, but it's like got about 10 examples in there.
No, it is. I mean, it is a complicated issue, and you do break it down really good in the book. I mean, you know, and I just think it just. I think coming up with the solution to it, there's a few different models, but it just reveals such a basic antagonism, or most people understand what a home is. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, like, it's an issue where it is hard because so many, like you said, so many things are wrapped up in it. People's ability to retire or fund education for their kids or whatever is all like people get very, very, you know, tight. They grasp onto it. But like, oh damn, I just lost my train of thought. Sorry, go ahead, David.
Matt jumped on me and forgot what he was going to say.
It's because okay. I felt bad for jumping on top of you.
It's all right. No, I mean, all I was saying is it's just like, it's such a clear, example of where capitalism perverts things that are very simple, in the sense of like, we all know what a home is. A home is where you live. A home is where you raise your family. But for capitalism, a home is equity. its value, its use for its exchange value, and how much you can sell it for. And the vast majority of housing policy in the United States right now is all set up to do one thing, and it's to get those property values going up, 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 up for homeowners, which creates a contradiction for people who are left out of that system because they can't get in.
Yeah, exactly. And it replicates, you know, so in one way, we talk about homeownership as a way for people of color to have some parity and to have like a source of wealth and for closing the wealth gap. But homeownership also reinforces the wealth gap, you know, It reinforces inequality because then once you become a homeowner, you don't necessarily want apartments being near you. Everybody's not going to own or rent an apartment. Or I should say, everybody's not going to be able to own a house. So you will regularly have like a class of renters, you know, so it does create these kinds of contradictions. And so I think the lesson that I was hoping to paint with or glean from that chapter is just to say we should at least have options. And I feel like under our current capitalist system, the option is because everything else has been so underfunded and so underdeveloped, and there's been so much like rhetoric around the American dream being homeownership that we haven't, you know, given our other options a shot, you know? But homeownership gives us, you know, we get mixed messages. So why do we want this kind of complicated relationship when, you know, we can have other options to explore?
Right. And actually, that people see the need is what I was going to say. Like, certainly these sort of other models that you propose, I think maybe, I don't know, when I was paying North Dakota rent, I would be like, we don't need to do anything like that. I think everybody across the country can see the need to change this system. And whatever these other models, however they seem foreign to us, it also seems foreign to me to see my rent jacked up for extreme amounts for nothing. And I think people are, and it's not just New York now, everyone across the country sees that. And so, yeah, like paying a 99-year lease to the government, like, I think that sounds cool. Like, that sounds much cooler than this sort of whatever we got going on now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and if you look at the housing in Singapore, it looks cool. Like, you can tell that and again, it's a capitalist country. So, you know, these aren't like orthodox socialist solutions, but they are coming from people who are saying the private sector should not have a stranglehold over the options that we give to people, because we know that their primary goal is maximizing profit. The U.S. government, I mean, unless they're getting, you know, they're getting developer money, like that's not going to be their concern. Like we can, and we also have a choice in who we elect, you know, and what their values are, where they can invest in public housing or affordable housing that's subsidized by the government.
Well, no, I mean, I totally agree there. Well, in the last couple of minutes, people like go out, there's a link below, pick up this book and read it. It's really phenomenal. And one of the things I really liked about it was one, that it's extremely accessible. It's a great introduction to like capitalism and socialism, but it was also very rooted in like the left wing and socialist tradition, right? You're citing and quoting a lot of important thinkers and figures. You know, from people like Du Bois to Assata Shakur. I was very happy to see my friend, not my friend. I hope he's my friend. I'd like to be his friend one day. Evo Morales in there, to put a good big smile on my face. I was just wondering in the last couple of minutes, if you could maybe talk a little bit about like that radical tradition in the U.S. And also after people finish reading your excellent book, if maybe some of those other figures you think you might want to give a shout out for people to check out and read and become well-versed in.
Sure. I think, I think the easiest way to do it is just think sort of conceptually through the book. And so I started off looking at the intersections of race and class. And I you know, it's hard for me to remember who all is like American versus like some of them might be Caribbean. You know, I don't want to get the ethnicity wrong. I'm just saying Western. But Du Bois, you know, he is an American scholar. And I was actually surprised because the things that we learned about Du Bois was that, you know, he was just talking about the talented 10th, and then he had some debates with Booker T. Washington, and that was the end of his story. But Black Reconstruction was essentially a class-based critique, or I would say a race and class analysis that pushed back against the Communist Manifesto, or pushed back against Marx and Engels in general, by just looking at the importance of the Black working class and just what we mean by a proletariat in the U.S. Like, it was like a basically like a Marxist text. And so I really, or Du Boisian text, I would say. So I thought that a lot of his work was very valuable. I quote it in the second chapter, which is on race and class. But the title is The Boy Is Not Mine. Just to give people a heads up, like a lot of the chapters are based on movies or rom-coms and music, just songs and things like that. And so in The Boy Is Not Mine, you know, you got these two girls who are fighting over this dude that's like trying to play them. And so essentially I'm comparing capitalists to someone who tries to play us against each other, and they always try and win out at the end. But at the end of the video, I know I'm going on a tangent. I was talking about The Boy. But Brandy and Monica, they come together to like, they realize that they've been played. So I'm just saying that that's what we need to do with race. And so that is a bit of Du Bois's argument in Black Reconstruction. He's not talking about Brandy and Monica, but he is talking about this bigger player called capitalism. And then I go into looking at Black Marxism from Cedric Robinson. I talk about Eric Williams. I quote Assata Shakur because she talks about how colonialism and fights against it were rooted in socialism, like in black countries that had been colonized. So yeah, there's just, I really wanted to center socialists of color to beat back on this stereotype and a very convenient, you know, rhetoric that, oh, this is just like for white people. Because that's, you know, it's just such a ignorant and I think convenient way to detract from how capitalism sucks for a lot of us. So yeah, I featured their work, but then I also, you know, obviously bring up Angela Davis and Claudia Jones, Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote for a communist. She identified as communist. She was the playwright who wrote A Raisin in the Sun, the first drama to appear on Broadway. There's just so many. Paul Robeson, Malcolm X, mm-hmm. Martin Luther King. I could go on and on. Bayard Rustin, A. Philip Randolph. They all get you know, an analysis in the book.
No, it's really phenomenal. I will just say, I mean, unless you have anything you want to add to it, it's like one thing as a socialist and as a white socialist, I get frustrated sometimes with some people who say, well, oh, you know, the Black freedom struggle was like very influenced by like Marxism. It's like true, but also like these are people who were like interacting and adding to the literature and the discourse and the theory. And it can be really frustrating, I will say, from people of like my background when they sort of talk about it as if, I don't know, these aren't people who like, I mean, as you're saying, Du Bois like is reacting to things in Marxism that need to be developed further. And I think that that's a really important tradition that a lot of people sort of miss in the socialist movement today.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I would say, you know, with like African decolonization movements, a lot of it is based on principles and practices of communalism that existed, you know, before there was this formal idea around communism. I was like, formal, that's the word. you know, and so we talk about that in some of the groups that I grew up in, because thinking about land communally, thinking about resources as a community, it was just a part of the value system, you know. And America is rooted in individualism, and so are a lot of other Western countries.
Well, Malaika Jabali, thank you so much for joining us, folks. The book is It's Not You, It's Capitalism. There we go, right there. It's really, yeah, show some of the illustrations if you don't mind, actually. Oh,
I know we're wrapping up, but this was a fun one. And shout out to Kayla E. She designed and illustrated the book. But we're like, how do we depict these, like, basically brainwashed Americans who conflate communism with like everything. And so she was like, you know, why don't we depict it as like a Reddit thread? So it's like a, so all the people who are real people who I went through like the archives to look at people's comments to federal regulations. Mm-hmm. And so she made up like usernames for them and like made a Reddit thread where it's like, the thread is called Stop Socialism. With like mundane things that they're complaining, like seatbelts and airbags to communism. Yeah. So it's so absurd. So yeah, it's just a lot of fun stuff like that in there. So proud of that.
it's a really phenomenal book. So people, there's a link below for people to pick it up. You should also be following Malaika's work everywhere, but including in Essence magazine. It's been way too long, Malaika. Thank you so much for joining us again, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the support and amplifying it. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Malaika.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everybody. Man, really such a pleasure to have Malaika on the program again. And I can't suggest the book enough, really. It's a lot of fun. As we said in the interview, I mean, like, a lot of times when you read a book critiquing capitalism, is all super important, but it could be a little dry. This is a very entertaining read.
No, I mean, that and, like, the way, like, it's really good coffee table book and gift, I think, for folks, because it's, you can really just open it up and there's a little, like, you know, lesson.
Yeah, 100%. But I mean, like, honestly, this sticks with the theme here. You know, a lot of really dark news and difficult times, but there is something that we should celebrate, and that is one of the most massive moments in the American labor movement in recent history, and that is the fact that the UAW has now announced that all of the big three have agreed to a tentative agreement, Ford being the first, and now GM and Stellantis are coming to the table. We'll talk a little bit more in depth about the things that are in it, what this means. We have some clips here, but I just want people to understand some of these really top-line historic things. First of all, let's just talk about one of the things that they were able to get from Stellantis. Stellantis agreed to reopen its idled Belvedere assembly plant, which is just an incredible flexing of the muscle of this movement. Not only getting a better contract, better wages, better benefits, all these other kind of things, but actually dictating to the company that, hey, you're not going to pull away people's livelihoods from them. You're not going to decimate communities. This has been a huge part of the UAW's rallying cry right now, is that capitalists and bosses are making decisions that affect entire regions, that decimate entire regions, and they're no longer going to play ball with that. So being able to force Stellantis to reopen this plant is massive. On top of that, there's the expansion in GM and Stellantis of the contract to new battery plant workers. Another big part of this fight has been about, will the green transition be used to break labor? They're able to get tremendous victories there. Tremendous amounts of workers are going to see their pay doubled. You know, remember, this all comes from the success of the stand-up strike. The stand-up strike has been proven as a tremendously effective tool. Over the weekend, right, in the final days of negotiation, now that GM and Stellantis have come to the table, you saw another massive walkout in Spring Hill, Tennessee, on Saturday, a very profitable plant, right, that also crippled and weakened the bargaining position of these big three auto companies. At this point, it's unarguable how effective and correct the stand-up strike strategy is, and I'm probably going to just put a pin on using today as maybe a victory lap for all the naysayers out there, but a tremendous, tremendous victory, and, you know, full solidarity to the UAW and Sean Fain. And maybe, Matt, I know you probably have plenty to say about this. We have some more updates, but let's just really briefly, let's go to the big talk himself, Sean Fain, just a couple seconds of him announcing this victory here, because, you know, they deserve all the celebration they can get.
We have won record agreements at Ford, Stellantis, and now GM. We have united our membership like never before. We have shown the companies, the American public, and the whole world that the working class is not done fighting. In fact, we're just getting started. We have...
And on that... just getting started, I think we can get there in just a second. There's been some pretty significant trickle-down effects, but I don't want to hog the microphone, Matt. I know you're just as amped about this as I am. I mean, you know, fuck yeah. You know, there's always the fear when a moment like this happens that it ends in failure, defeat. This is a pretty big event here.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, like, just the stakes here and... you know, like I wanted to believe in the stand-up strike, and everything I read about it was like, yeah, this seems like a good idea. You still don't know, right? It's like almost like anything can happen on game day. And to see them get all three secured and be able to send, you know, these things back to their membership, It's inspiring, and I must admit I feel a sense of relief because we've seen things like this go the opposite way, mm-hmm. and the message that it sends. And again, maybe we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but like if I am any kind of factory worker, especially in the automotive industry, I look mm-hmm. at these sorts of victories and I'm like, guys, we need that here. Yes. And like that's Fain bringing home the goods.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it would just be irresponsible. We can't talk about this if we don't talk about this other demand, this other aspect of these announcements. Well, just really fast, I just want to remind people, because I know everyone has different experiences and levels of knowledge about this. This is something that cynics and people who want to see these movements fail oftentimes utilize to confuse people. These are tentative agreements. What does that mean? It means that they, in principle, the company and the negotiating team have come to an agreement. Who gets the final say here? Is it secret union bureaucrats behind closed doors? No, it's the membership. So now the membership has the opportunity to have their voice heard. We'll play some clips of some workers reacting to this deal in a second. But just don't let anybody get away with saying, oh, well, you know, they were scared and they negotiated the secret deal behind closed doors. No, the workers get full access to the deal and they will decide whether or not they want to accept it. Very likely that they will because it is a damn good deal. But it's not my position one way or the other to say what these people, what these workers should do. But you can't sit here and say that this has been, a failure. It's been a massive success. And what does this mean for the labor movement as a whole? It's massive. So here's Sean Fain announcing this first deal. I believe this is their first announcement on Ford. I think this was all big three. Anyway, this has been moving pretty fast. But listen to what he says here. Anyone who thinks that, oh, this means that the UAW is done fighting or the fight being over, you're going to be in for a big surprise here.
We went to each of the big three and proposed an expiration date of April 30th, 2028. We did this for several reasons. First, this allows us to strike on May Day or International Workers' Day. May Day was born out of an intense struggle by workers in the United States to win an 8-hour day. That's a struggle that is just as relevant today as it was in 1889. Even though May Day has its roots here in the United States, it is widely celebrated by workers all over the world. It's more than just a day of commemoration. It's a call to action. We invite unions around the country to align your contract expirations with our own so that together we can begin to flex our collective muscles. If we're going to truly take on the billionaire class and rebuild the economy so that it starts to work for the benefit of the many and not the few, then it's important that we not only strike, but that we strike.
This is it. This is why we've been supportive of Sean Fain and the UAW, just like we're supportive of unions across the board. But the reason we have been extraly, excited and motivated and passionate about this is because Sean Fain has, one, been using the language of class war from the get-go. He's been talking about how this strike is not just for the UAW members, but it's for a working class as a whole. And this is putting that strategy in alignment here. What is he demanding here? He is saying to all of the other unions across the country to have your contracts expire on this same day so that the next time, that workers need to go on strike, they can be able to do it collectively. So it's not just shutting down the automotive industry. It's not just shutting down the shipping and logistics industry. It's not just shutting down, railroads or things like that. It's the working class as a whole building out the capacity to do something that we haven't seen in this country in a damn long time, which is a general strike. That is the kind of thing that he's talking about here, is the kind of thing that takes tremendous amounts of organizing, by the way. It's not just some kind of wish or thing that you declare. It's something that takes a lot of effort, work, and strategizing to be able to do. And this is laying down the foundation to be able to do this across the board. It is one of the most important developments and dynamics in the labor movement in my lifetime, and probably in a century, frankly. Matt, you're muted.
Sorry. I think, like, when I read about Walter Reuther, there's a book, The Most Dangerous Man in Detroit, I believe, that's available online. And, you know, it goes, like, helped organize with the UAW the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Like, this is what we need unions to be doing, and it's not out of line with what the UAW has done. And I think that's what's inspired about Fain is his sense of history, down to like the stand-up strike and mm-hmm. the historical inspiration there. It's like, finally we have leaders that aren't acting like they're reinventing the wheel, but are in fact part of a struggle that's been going on for hundreds of years, and has been understood with the correct contours, despite not being won.
Mm-hmm. Let's just really quick top on. We're going to do a lot more, on the specifics of the contract in the next couple of weeks here. But just some quick highlights. We went over a few of them before, but just specifically on the Ford contract. This is from a Labor Notes story by Dan DiMaggio, titled "Big Three Buckled as Stand-Up Strike Spread," which is an incredible title there. Says 25%, this is the Ford plants, 25% wage increases over 4.5 years, including 11% immediately. It reinstates COLA, cost of living adjustments, a major goal. And this is, again, something if you're not familiar with the labor movement in this country, you might miss. Cost of COLA, as it's known, cost of living adjustments, mean that in addition to your kind of yearly raises, there is just an automatic cost of living adjustment. So that means if there's inflation, if the cost of living in your community goes up significantly, your wages just go up. They don't even have to negotiate that. That is, there's a formula, it's calculated, and that is on top of the salary increases that you get from the first bit. That's massive in a country where we have seen wage gains be eaten up by inflation for decades. This is something that people for years said, oh, COLA will never come back. COLA is, thing of the past. Well, they want it. And it is something that's incredibly massive. It will take only 3 years now to get to top pay as a UAW worker at the Ford plants rather than 8. And temporary workers who are currently employed will be transferred to full-time after 90 days. And from now on, new temporary hires will be transferred over to full-time employees in just 9 months, a process that used to take years. Right. So there are some things that they didn't get the full extent of what they demanded, but they got tremendous, tremendous victories from the companies. And remember, the companies, when we first started covering this, man, I mean, what did the companies say? We've provided everything that right. we can. Bullshit. The UAW
you are going
was
to destroy. I mean, it's been so infuriating because yeah, their tone was, if you fuck this up for us, we might not have an auto industry in this country. Mm-hmm. And you look at the reality, it's like, well, why have you been doing stock buybacks? Why haven't you been reinvesting into this company, right? And because it's all lies. It's because mm-hmm. criminals run these organizations, a whole class called executives, and all they care about is pumping up the stock market so their compensation is higher. They don't care about the long-term success or even health of these businesses. So, I mean, this is... Honestly, people should feel patriotic, frankly, about what's happened here.
Patriotic to the working class, man. I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing that we need. And let's just talk a little bit about what this does for the rest of the working class. In that speech later, Fain said one of the reasons that they put forward this four-year contract is expansion, baby. The UAW is planning, working right now to organize in non-union automakers from Tesla, Toyota, Volkswagen, Mercedes, BMW, Honda, Nissan, and other automakers, particularly in places across the South where a lot of these auto companies have gone to take advantage of lower union density and workers who they think are easier to exploit. This has been a pretty massive shift, and we'll talk about some of the trickle-down effects in just a second, but just quoting Sean Fain himself, he says, when we return to the bargaining table in 2028, it won't just be with the big three, but with the big five or the big six, he said. So they're talking real stuff here, not just the old kind of defensive posturing that we've gotten from American labor, right, which has been under assault for decades. We're going to protect what we got. He says, no, we're going to take more, get a bigger contract, and we're also going to utilize that to springboard and expand. Huge news already, just days after these first announcements came out. Bloomberg is reporting Tesla's workers at Tesla's Fremont, California car factory have formed an organizing committee with the United Auto Workers Union right now. So there's a huge union push that's going on in Fremont, California. We'd like to see that all across Tesla facilities across this country. And what does this mean for people who work for Toyota and a lot of these other car companies? This here from More Perfect Union, quoting the Labor Notes story, right after the UAW announced they're trying to organize other auto plants across the United States, Labor Notes was contacted by a Toyota worker in Alabama who said management had called an emergency meeting. They say Toyota is raising pay, top pay to $32 an hour. And that Labor Notes reporter is somebody who you should definitely be following and reading, is Louise Feliz Leon, who said on Twitter just this afternoon, Labor Notes, me, has been in touch with workers at Toyota, Alabama, and Kentucky, including other auto workers at Mercedes, Hyundai, etc. So it wasn't out of the blue. Look out for another Labor Notes story on how the UAW wins are reverberating across the auto sector. And if you just give me 1 second, I'll pull up more of his reporting here, where we are already getting, a response from the companies, and it's a response of fear, which means that they are already trying to raise benefits for workers. Toyota is scared. Text from a source, graphics circulating on Facebook. Wage increases at Toyota, again, a non-union facility, along with this text that Lewis shared with everybody. Toyota gave us an emergency meeting today and told us that we were getting a pay raise and shorter top out time to look similar to what happened at the big three. It's exactly what the union won, and not better, but after 4 years, you top out at 32 instead of it being 8 years. So we're already seeing trickle down effects for workers, even in the non-union sector. And what does this mean for all those people? Hey, being in a union makes a lot of sense because it gets you good thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it's just a coincidence that Toyota decided to, I guess it's Christmas today.
Well, you know, and I guess they didn't have the money. No, they all have the fucking money. And yep. It's very, very clear here. So we'll have more on this. But before we go, I did want to share some voices from the labor movement, some reactions from workers themselves. This was shared by More Perfect Union as well, which we all know is an incredible source on the American labor movement. But yeah, we'll just play a couple minutes of this. This is workers reacting to this deal here.
I think the last time there was a wage increase of that size was back in the 1940s or 1950s after the end of World War II.
It's a record contract. That absolutely is.
They're not wrong when they say these are some of the biggest gains we've had since at least I've started.
Yeah, and I had to see the details, but the raise sounds substantial, right? Not quite where we wanted to be, but it's substantial.
You know, I've seen our standard of living decline contract after contract, and this contract offers us an improvement in our...
Don't know why I did that, sorry.
It was back in the 1940s or 1950s after the end of World War II.
It's a record.
So, I mean, this is just a massive, victory here, and it will go back to the workers and people decide, but it's already having trickle-down effects. The stand-up strike was a tremendously correct and effective strategy. The labor movement's not going anywhere, folks. It's about to get even realer and expand even more, and we're very thankful to the people in the UAW, all the folks who did the work, not just during the strike, but to democratize and open up that union. Let's not forget that Sean Fain is elected because you saw this massive democratization process within the United Auto Workers Union. This is what happens when you have more democratic unions, folks. This is why those fights even within the union are important to put more power in the hands of the members. This is the kind of stuff that can get delivered then. So I want to see a hell of a lot more of it. Thank you very much, Mr. President Sean Fain, the only president I respect, and looking forward to what's next.
Yesterday in studio, I had a really good Fain impression going that I feel like I might need to.
I've been working on mine too.
Look, all you busters that said we shouldn't do the stand-up strike, SMD.
And now I think everyone, we need to get some of those Eat the Rich hoodies for Left Reckoning, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
But man, hell yeah, y'all. I mean, you know, in a time, it's a very difficult and dark time. We're all going through it. Everyone is devastated about what's going on across the globe, particularly in Gaza. But this is a bright spot. And it also is the pathway forward from everything to improving the lives of American workers, but also to building up the movements that can push back against this imperialism and destruction abroad. It's going to take the working class to take a leading role in politics and in the society. And this is exactly how that kind of thing starts in earnest.
Yes. And, you know, one other note is, as we grow this labor movement, it will be able to stand up for, I think, broader issues. Like there are, I believe it's Swedish or some Scandinavian country where isn't going to make anything for Israel, right? Like that's the way to actually address this thing. Now it's tough because these sorts of foreign policy things have always been difficult for American labor to deal with or been used as a wedge issue. But without them there, like, I mean, just look at this the past couple of weeks as we've had this victory. If we hadn't had any sort of labor movement, even in the past couple of years, we would just have the cravenness of the Biden administration and the dead end that that represents. And, you know, the scale of what we're seeing in Gaza right now is different, but that's pretty much what you get from the status quo American establishment. So we need to push on these other levels to try to get some, you know, sense of justice back into politics.
Absolutely. And without the, you know, this is the way, this is the only way that things are going to change because the status quo is not an option anymore. So congratulations to everybody at the UAW. We will be covering much, much more in depth in the future, but there's a moment where you need to be able to celebrate your victories. And this is a big one. This is a big one, y'all. Thanks everybody for tuning in to this episode of Left Reckoning. It was tough. I mean, the stories we're hearing out of Gaza are horrific, but it was an honor to be joined by Malaika Jabali. People check out her work in Essence. Also, please read her book. It's really phenomenal. It was great to have her on the program, and we definitely will need to have her back on soon. It's not over. It's Halloween, y'all. It felt a little silly to say that earlier, but it's Halloween, y'all. Matt and I are going to be over in the post game. You get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning. And this morning when I was walking around, I got a little buzz on my phone and it was Mr. Matt Leck saying, "Hey man, do you think we can tell some spooky stories in the post game?" And I was like, "Yes, sir, let's do it." So Matt's got some spooky stories for us. We're going to have a lot of fun with all of y'all, maybe take some calls and questions. So come over and enjoy, spend some of your Halloween evening, some more of your Halloween evening with us in the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning to do so. Appreciate all of y'all so much. Keep up the fight and we'll see you soon.
Peace.